Good morning, folks. Hope you're having a great Thursday morning. We've got a great lineup for you today. We'll visit with Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. We'll talk about the legislature downsizing the New Orleans judiciary. We'll talk about changes in the number of state-funded district attorneys in New Orleans and a recent incident involving St. Tammany Parish Sheriff Randy Smith and more. At 11:10, we'll visit with Kelly Schultz. Restaurant Week is in town. She is the Senior Vice President of Communications and Public Relations for New Orleans & Company. Mark Katz joins us at 10:30. He's the Professor Emeritus at George Mason University and a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. We'll talk about the successes most recently of the Ukraine military, their major drone attacks against Russia as this war drags on. And every month, Chief Ann Kirkpatrick joins us, the NOPD superintendent, and she's with us this morning. Chief, welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning, Sheriff.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Let's got a lot of ground to cover. Let's start out. You, I think, are going to have a press conference this afternoon talking about the strategies that will be deployed, I guess, relative to car clubs, these burnout parties that go on intersections. Tell us about it.
Yes, thank you. We are expecting tomorrow, Saturday evening, for a large attempt to do a takeover of our streets from the car clubs. At least this is what some of the intelligence that we have been told about. And so we have an operations plan set. We're not going to allow that to happen. And so hopefully that is not going to happen, although people are always welcome to come and show their cars, but they cannot do takeovers.
It's incredibly dangerous, right? A lot of times, folks' reaction to that is completely and totally understated. Agreed?
Yes, you know, it's an interesting phenomenon, but this idea, they call them sideshows on the West Coast, and Oakland was one of the epicenters for this sideshow activity. And while I was there, and they have grown over time with cars and hundreds of spectators, guns, people get hurt and injured, and sometimes one or two incidences of being killed. It is really chaotic, very, very dangerous. And so here in New Orleans, we have great leadership within our city council, our mayor, our community, and we're just not going to tolerate it here.
Interestingly, they kind of don't hide the fact. They're very overt about it. They advertise that they're coming on social media, right?
Yeah, they do. Yeah,
it's like, we're coming, and we're coming in numbers, right?
Right. So that's why, you know, we want to do a press, conference on this, because this is, I understand it has happened here in New Orleans before, but not since I've been here. So you probably even may have experienced it, Sheriff, when you were a sitting sheriff. But they can become really quite dangerous. And even you just mentioned that they're quite open about it. They advertise. And we actually have an ordinance, a criminal ordinance for spectators at illegal street racing and stunt events, and for people who actually advertise it. And so we have criminal statutes, and I will not hesitate to enforce them if I must.
Yeah. Well, I think, putting pressure on them always is an effective strategy, moving them away. It's kind of amazing how they take over and in some jurisdictions, they just allow it to happen. I happened to be visiting the city of Memphis one day and ran across three in about 20 minutes as we were walking across the city. And it was just complete bedlam. I mean,
it was
crazy.
Memphis is my hometown. I used to be a police officer there. And if a community does not, or council or whatever, does not support strong enforcement action, it is truly what the word takeover is correct. It's bedlam. It is chaos. It is anything but publicly safe. And so you're correct. I mean, it's just wild.
Yeah. Let's pivot to another top of mind issue. I know one that we've talked about every time you've been on the show, recruitment. Where do we stand?
Oh, gosh, what a great story we're beginning to have on that topic, Sheriff. We have pivoted. So we have been doing campaigns that include TikToks, that include, we're going to be rolling out new advertisement campaign that we've developed. We have doubled our numbers now in terms of applicants. And so, and we've also improved the percentage from the applicants who actually do then come in and literally begin the process through the testing. So we have doubled that. We've sustained those numbers now for 2 months in a row. And so we're very, very pleased. We think we have a good story to tell, and that now we're beginning to fire on all pistons.
That feels great, right?
Yeah.
I mean, when you implement these things and you begin to see the fruits of your labor.
Well, exactly. And, you know, I have to give a big time shout out to the recruiting team, to every member who has worked in that unit. I mean, it's been challenging. It's been frustrating. It's been hard for them, but they stayed the course, and they have really, and now they get to see the fruit of their efforts.
Absolutely. And that's good news. That's a good segue into something that has been challenging for y'all, overtime management. And when you have more people, you obviously have less overtime. Where do we stand there? There's been some recent stories that have been published, and I know you guys were thinking about changing some things internally. Talk to us about that issue.
Sure, I appreciate that, because that too, it is always a disappointment when you see potential misconduct occurring. But I will say that the few events that have been out in the public's eye, that's not really representative of our department overall. However, we have needed to improve systems, and we have. So, for instance, you are aware that we've reinstituted biometric clocks. That was not new for New Orleans Police. Our staff here was accustomed to using biometrics. However, as I have learned during the COVID years, we fell away from that. And so we are just reestablishing what had been a part of our culture. And so that also anchors an accountability structure. So things along those lines, we are working toward tightening systems.
Do you feel like that you have the buy-in of, you know, mostly the rank? I mean, I've always been a firm believer in speed of the leader, speed of the pack. I mean, most recently, some of the stories that broke were about leadership, not taking this very seriously, going on the clock and still being at home. And whether or not that's 30 minutes or 40 minutes, it's really of no moment, in my view, because you lead by example, and when others see that that's what you're doing, they're going to do it. It's human nature.
It's human nature. Yes, you're correct. It is what it is. I will say that I can't just put all of this at the foot of supervisors. One very fair pushback that was brought to me in a meeting when we were addressing this, and everyone knows that I will champion this department, and I will stand for these officers and professional staff when they are in the right, but that I don't suffer foolishness well. And the question was, is this a leadership breakdown? What is this? In fairness, you know, we have been void of supervision. You know, we cannot promote up to sergeants and lieutenants when we don't have enough officers. So it's all tied together. So we've had many shifts that didn't even have lieutenants, we didn't have enough sergeants. And so it can't just all be a leadership issue. We have good leaders here. Do we have failure? Yes. And it is human nature. The question I ask myself, and everybody should be asking, is this culture or is this individuals who, You know, we still have people under investigation, and that doesn't mean they've done wrongdoing yet. They have to explain themselves. We see you on camera at home. Do you have an explanation? And they may very well have a good one, but the community doesn't know that because the story isn't over. And so it seems as though without a doubt, we've got to tighten the ships around the help. You know, I want to run a right and tight ship.
But it seems to me that the most appropriate resolution incumbent upon the individual is that if, in fact, they have a legitimate explanation, that the follow through is that they remedy the payroll record.
And correct.
So that it accurately reflects your activity that day, right? You know, and it, but there seems to be a failure to do so. And that's where, you know, I think kind of the rubber meets the road here as to what is actually the expectation of the individuals in remedying. Every, you know, there are things that happen that are outside of people's control that may delay them in getting in. That happens. You know, I've been there. I've managed through that. Yeah. But did they cure the record? And that's the important thing at the end of the day.
Exactly right. The record, we are individually responsible for the hours that we work. We are public servants. People, therefore, the public has the right to look at us. No, that's a given. I do have, and I will say, though, that I've had some concern about the way that the officers may have been under investigation or scrutiny, where let's say cameras have been picking up officers at their home. Why show where an officer lives? That's very dangerous for an officer, for their family, that type of thing. I've been concerned about that. And but we do have to own our record. There must be accountability. But they do have an opportunity to explain themselves. Why were you here when you were supposed to be here? And what did you do to cure the record? If they cannot explain that, the few who are under investigation, then people will be held accountable.
Yeah. You know, it's really a shame because, as you mentioned, the vast majority of the officers play by the rules.
Yeah.
And then the organization's reputation is tainted by the actions of a few, right? We've all been there as managers. We've all been there as commanders, you know, having to make these tough decisions and follow through on whether or not these records are accurate. They're working there. We always had dashboards internally when people got to a certain overtime level. The bells and whistles went off, and we started looking as to whether or not it was legitimate or not, and then utilizing that against the detail records, which is a whole nother morass of issues for most police departments that allow police details. It's difficult to manage appropriately and takes a lot of time.
It takes time. It takes the right people looking at that. But you are correct. We are building those systems to have the bells and whistles that go off that say, hey, we have officers working too many hours. We have implemented these corrective courses of action that we will talk with these officers and staff if we see these numbers climbing. And, you know, overtime is not a given, nor is it detailed. You have to have approval for that. We've tightened down the expectations of supervisors not approving some overtime if they think the officer is working too much. All of these things did have to have a reset. And you were correct. It's very detail-oriented with the right bells and whistles and early intervention programs.
Certainly. Let's talk about some good news. I was looking at the crime stats. I love when we see multi-month trends, and now even over a period of a year and a half, 18 months, continued reductions in almost every category. I think there might have only been one where there was a slight increase, but all the others seem to all be on a downward trend. Talk to us about that.
Yes, and so we've, you know, basically have had 3 years now, particularly in our murders, that have continued to drop at double digits. And we are, you hear me reference, we work a defined strategy. Now, we're building on this strategy this year with some additional approaches, such as notifications from the Bureau of Prisons, hopefully also with OPSO and our new sheriff, to inform us when high-risk offenders are being released back into the community, to let us know when they are, so that we can help with the rehabilitation to not reoffend. And so with custom notifications that we are going to be watching. And so we have a lot more strategies that we're going to build on the successful ones we've already seen the fruit of. So we're pleased to see that these numbers are holding and continuing to drop.
I know that y'all have done a lot of task force work, and that seems to be delivering some really big results. And I love reading the stories, and I'm sure you do too, when you look at dailies and you see where they're following the evidence and one thing leads to another, and what they thought the initial investigation was about turns out to be something entirely different, and you start making all kinds of other peripheral cases, excuse me. I don't know about you, but man, those used to make my day. You know,
yeah, it does make my day.
You know, it was like
it does. And, you know, we've said it about the partnerships. But, you know, that sounds almost like a bumper sticker. You're just, you know, we have partnerships.
Yeah, sure.
The truth of the matter is we actually do have partnerships. We get along with our fellow agencies. We work as one team with one goal, even though we may have different lanes. But it's no different than putting a team together in a sports. And I think that, you know, we know how to put the right people in the right seats, and they're doing just incredible work, and they work well together.
Yeah, it's good to see that. Chief, there was a couple of things that have happened over the past several weeks. One, not typically within your control, but one, there was a story about the crime lab and the physical structure of it, the finding of mold, and you know the delays there. I know y'all have tried to move feverishly for the implementation of the DNA lab. And when you hear these stories, it's like, oh my God, here we go again. Your thoughts and where do y'all stand with that?
Well, you know, the one thing as an outsider coming in that really was like, wow, is the infrastructure issues at hand. So we're circling back, and that's on a macro basis, the physical plants that may have been a lot associated even with Katrina and the flooding, and then allows for the mold and things like that to grow in our buildings. But this particular crime lab is a new building. And so it was not built to the specifications to be able to do the DNA. And that is between the city administration and the builder for any kind of remedies there. Regardless, we've got to have the building into compliance so we can do the work and also be an accredited lab. So, you know, I'm on the periphery of that, although the lab technicians and staff are NOPD employees. So, yes, I have oversight of the personnel and what they do, but the building itself, that is really more, like you said, is not necessarily within my something I can do about it.
Have they given you a timeline? Have they, I mean, because, you know, it's got to be really frustrating. I mean, it's as you know, you and I mean, we both realize how important of a tool that is. And when that tool's not in the toolbox, you know, and you're relying on third parties, and God bless them, but you don't have it under your control, and you don't set the priorities the moment that you have to step outside of of your sphere, so to speak.
Sure.
Have they articulated?
Yeah. Sorry, I stepped on you there, Sheriff. Yes, there is a timeline. No. We would like to try to get this up and going by 2027 or the end of 2027 because of the accreditation timeline. And I will have to credit the city, everybody who is involved there, from the mayor to the council to people who work on facilities. There is an awareness of the timeline, and there is movement associated with it. So it's just one of those events, though. It's going to require a rebuild of one of the floors. One of the floors that would be our DNA lab has to be redone.
Yeah. You know, because as I look at, you know, one of the next topics, and we're running out of time, but it's just so important because three less judges, five less warrants or 10 less warrants for the DA's office. I don't know what that's going to translate to, but throughput in that court that's the key issue. You know, moving as many cases as you can and selectively incapacitating the impact criminal and getting these cases to fruition. And when you have these evidentiary tools that are not readily available to you and not under your control, and you're relying on third parties, it impacts throughput in a huge way because you're not a priority, you know, and it's much better when you're the center of the universe, right, than when you're not. And, you know, and it seems to me that this is now is a heightened priority in light of this most recent changes.
Right. You know, you really frame our topics very, very well, Sheriff. So you hit the nail on the head, but there is an axiom out there that justice delayed is justice denied. And so efficiencies do matter. And when you slow down on the ability to move cases through the entire system, from the point of arrest, from the point of the investigations to prosecutions, as we talk about is the criminal justice system. So with fewer judges, fewer courtrooms, fewer everything, you know, if there's a cog in the process, then you do not get to the end result. And therefore, justice is really, I think, truly impacted. It's like if I did my misconduct today, I don't want to get my spanking a year from now. Give me my spanking today. Don't give me my spanking a year from now. So it's it matters when it comes to public safety, how long and how slow justice is.
Yeah, truly. As always, Chief, we know that you're very busy. We really appreciate you sitting down with us this morning and spending this time with us, and have a great weekend.
Thank you. Always a pleasure, Sheriff.
Thank you, ma'am. That's Chief Ann Kirkpatrick, Superintendent of the NOPD. We'll be right back, folks. When we return, we'll visit with Mark Katz, Professor Emeritus at George Mason University and a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. And we'll talk about the state of the Ukraine-Russian war. We'll be right back. Stay with us. For the past several weeks and maybe even over a month, the Middle East has really gotten most of the attention as it relates to war or conflict. Meanwhile, there's the conflict there and war that's going on between Russia and Ukraine. And when I think about it, I can't help but make the analogy of the biblical story of David and Goliath. And the most recent reporting is really kind of incredible about how Ukraine is becoming more innovative, more overt, more aggressive, and more successful in a lot of what they do with little or nothing as it relates to assets and resources. It's really a compelling story. Here to talk to us about that, Mark Katz, Professor Emeritus at George Mason University and a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Mark, I don't know if I'm misstating, overstating, or what, but I just, as I look at this story unfold each and every day, it does remind me of this biblical story. And I mean, it's amazing some of the stuff that Ukraine has been able to achieve when, you know, for decades now, we have thought that the prowess of Russia was far greater than what they've exhibited thus far in this war, in my view.
Well, I think you're right. I think David and Goliath is the correct analogy. And I think what's fascinating is that, the Ukrainians have, just innovated tremendously with regard to how to defend themselves and how to use drones and striking deep into Russia and hurting its military and economic assets, and even regaining some of the lost territory. It is tremendous. And the Russian, essentially response is to bomb civilians and to expend even more lives on the front lines. That they don't seem to be, if they have this greater prowess, they don't seem to be using it. But the fact of the matter is, I just don't think that they are as strong as they thought they were.
The Russians seem to be fighting two fronts right now. One, the front with Ukraine, obviously, and one, this information battle relative to how they are actually, this is going to sound weird, marketing this war to their resident population. And there seems to be a lot of cracks and fissures that are appearing as more and more the public is recognizing that they're not in as good a position as the leaders of the Russian hierarchy are telling them, right?
Yeah, this war has now lasted longer than, Soviet war, 1941 to 45 against the Nazis. And, they've not done nearly as well, but they're making an awful lot of sacrifices. So I think the Russian public is unhappy. Now, that survey work that has been done indicates that the Russians sort of generally support Putin's aims as long as they themselves don't have to fight the war. But I think that what they're finding is that it involves costs for them as well, and they're not happy.
The Russians early onset were able to bring some proxies in to help fight the war. It seems as though those requests are being rejected and the numbers are shrinking. Is that true?
Yeah, I think they've gotten a lot of bad press. They've recruited, from a lot of places, from African countries, etc., in South Asia, Middle East, advertising, jobs in Russia, and then suddenly people find themselves in the military and not able to leave. And I think that news about this has spread, and so I think that it's not been good for Russia at all.
From the Ukrainian perspective, it seems now that their strategy centers a lot around, I think, trying to embarrass Putin, right? They have these huge celebrations, some of it dealing with the military, some of it with some of the successes that they've had militarily, in history. And the Ukrainians seem to like to send in some drones and let them know, hey, you got this little guy over here that's nipping at your heels.
Yeah, and the latest example is this, annual St. Petersburg Economic Forum that Putin puts on. And, they launched some attacks during that, very embarrassing, I think, for Putin they're pretty good at this. Of course, Zelensky himself, of course, was a showman. So I think he has a real sense of what will embarrass Putin. And I think he's being successful at this.
If you had the benefit of the crystal ball, how does this end? I mean, it would seem to me that if NATO and the U.S. would release just a little more oomph, that the Ukrainians, with their abilities and what they've been able to show, their perseverance is like just unbelievable. I mean, they're fighting with stones for the most part and doing it successfully. Seems as though if they had just a little bit more oomph, they could bring an end to this.
Well, I would hope that would be the case, and that we would do more. But I think what's interesting about the Ukrainians is that they've done a lot of innovation themselves. Mm-hmm. Not only are they able, have they developed some pretty impressive anti-drone systems, but now they are helping out the Gulf countries, which are being attacked by Iran with Russian assistance. And this, I think, is something that, you know, Putin wasn't counting on. I think one of the things that the Ukrainians suffered from was that the so-called Global South was just not sympathetic. They just didn't think of it as their war. But now, you know, I think that we have some pretty important, very wealthy countries turning to Ukraine because they see it as being in their interest when it comes to their own defense. They now have a greater appreciation for Ukraine. And so I think on the diplomatic front, you know, Ukraine has done better. Now, in terms of how the war will end, you know, I personally have long thought that it's going to be a ceasefire in place, that's what we're going to see, that neither withdraws further. But I just think that so long as Vladimir Putin is in charge of Russia, he literally cannot stop, that his reputation is so much at stake that it won't be until he's out of power, I think, that then you can have a leadership that's not as invested and will be able to have a ceasefire. And I think that's what we're going to end up seeing at some point. The war will end because Putin has been overthrown.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see, you know, the territorial boundaries, because it almost seems in some of the most recent reporting that there's a, you correct me if I'm wrong, there's even this possibility of taking back Crimea, that, you know, the Russians there are really down and out, you know, and large sections of the Donbas as well.
You know, it is possible. Certainly, you know, some of the pro-Ukrainian, you know, commentators I've seen have been talking about this, and it seems like they're in a position, in a stronger position than now, to cut off Crimea from, you know, Russian resupply, or just make it harder and harder for them to stay there. So, you know, that is possible, but that's something I think Putin will really try to resist. It is amazing that Ukraine is doing as well as it has.
What is your takeaway? You mentioned something earlier, and about diplomatically what's going on. The NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, is his name, was visited Kyiv the other day. Any takeaways from that?
Well, what I just think it shows is that, you know, the Europeans understand that you know, their own defense is at stake. In other words, that if Ukraine falls, that they're going to be next, and that they're not nearly have the same capacity to resist that Ukraine does. Now, it's not a question of their, you know, being poor or anything like this. It's just that their societies are really not prepared for war, and therefore they have a real interest in helping the Ukrainians do the fighting. So, you know, I think that the Europeans are not all of them. You know, it's mixed across the continent, but certainly, you know, in terms of the Nordic states, the Baltic states, increasingly Germany, and, you know, Britain, obviously, France as well, I would say, are more interested in helping the Ukrainians. But there are others who just don't feel threatened, and just don't see that, you know, that they need to do this, or else maybe it's simply that they figure somebody else is going to do it for them.
These little small intrusive activity that the Russians have gotten themselves involved in with the Baltic states, in my view, has backfired on them. I think it's really kind of solidified, as you pointed out, the Nordic states, the Baltic states, and others. It was almost like, you know, Putin was being a little cutesy, and I think he's paying the price, because I think it ultimately solidified a number of these countries diplomatically. We only have a minute. Your thoughts?
Right. I think you're right. Certainly these states have always been afraid of Russia. And, you know, that Putin is not, I don't know what he's trying to accomplish, but for him to attack the Baltic states while the war in Ukraine is still going on would be silly.
Yeah, it's just kind of, I scratch my head on a lot of what's going on strategically from their side. I don't get it, but I'm almost glad he's he's doing it because it seems to be working against him in a big way and coalescing the other side. So we'll see. With Mark Katz, Professor Emeritus at George Mason University and a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, thank you so much for your time and your insight. We truly appreciate it.
And thank you for having me.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Hope you enjoyed that interview with Mark Katz. If you do any reading as it relates to the Russia-Ukraine war and you see what Ukraine has been able to pull together through innovation and just perseverance, it's absolutely nothing short of incredible and phenomenal, quite frankly. And I'm always moved by their attitude. And, you know, we've been able to speak about Ukraine with Arnie Filko. He has two adopted daughters from Ukraine and has been visiting over there and working with a group called Razam. And he has shared with us what they have been doing. And it's just incredible people, quite frankly. All the folks that I've had the opportunity to meet, been very, very impressed by them. I mean, the conditions that they're living in and attempting to survive in over there is just absolutely horrible, horrible, horrible what's going on. The Russians have attacked civilian targets repeatedly over and over and over again. They are war criminals of the worst kind. And I don't understand this coddling that's going on. Man, look, I know that they have nuclear weapons. I get it. But these folks have been able to really reveal the ineptitude and the lack of the oomph that the Russian military has. In fact, they don't have it. And it's been an interesting situation, but unfortunately, too many lives lost. It needs to come to an end, hopefully, sometime soon. We'll be right back. Folks, when we return after the top of the hour news break, we will visit with Kelly Schultz, Senior Vice President of Communications, and we'll talk about New Orleans Restaurant Week.